Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Hey, new book. We're up to book four. We've done Stephen Crane's The Open Boat, Stephen Crane's The Blue Hotel, James Joyce's Dubliners, and now we're up to Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. That's exciting. I'm actually pretty pumped for a bit of Wuthering Heights. I understand it's quite a dark, depressing story, as was Emily Bronte's life. One of the Bronte sisters, she had quite famous sisters in the literary world. The most famous, of course, being Charlotte Bronte, who wrote Jane Eyre. Emily Bronte's stories are, well, she only ever wrote one novel, and then she went ahead and died at the ripe old age of 30. She died before she knew of this book's success, before she knew Wuthering Heights was a hit. And the most grim, gruesome, depressing death, well, gruesome, and it may be not the word, and it makes it sound like it was quite gory, it wasn't. But have a listen to this. Emily's health was probably weakened by the harsh local climate and by unsanitary conditions at home, the source of water being contaminated by runoff from the church's graveyard. So she drank too much dead person juice and then died. Her house, the water at her house was runoff from a church's graveyard. That sounds like something from a dark, twisted bit of literature. But hey, and that happened before she knew that her book was successful. So there's a little bit of Emily Bronte, dark, gruesome trivia to start this thing off. And now, without any further ado, I say we jump straight in and read the first chapter of Wuthering Heights. Pretty excited to do so. It goes a little something like this. Chapter 1, 1801. I have just returned from a visit to my landlord, the solitary neighbour that I shall be troubled with. This is certainly a beautiful country. In all England I do not believe that I could have fixed on a situation so completely removed from the stir of society. A perfect misanthropist's haven. And Mr. Heathcliff and I are such a suitable pair to divide the desolation between us. A capital fellow. He little imagined how my heart warmed towards him when I beheld his black eyes withdraw so suspiciously under their brows as I rode up, and when his fingers sheltered themselves with a jealous resolution still further in his waistcoat as I announced my name. "Mr. Heathcliff," I said. A nod was the answer. "Mr. Lockwood, your new tenant, sir. I do myself the honour of calling as soon as possible after my arrival, to express the hope that I have not inconvenienced you by my perseverance in soliciting the occupation of Thrushcross Grange. I heard yesterday you had had some thoughts." "Thrushcross Grange is my own, sir," he interrupted, wincing. "I should not allow anyone to inconvenience me. If I could hinder it, walk in." The walk-in was uttered with closed teeth, and expressed the sentiment, "Go to the deuce." Even the gate over which he leant manifested no sympathizing movement to the words, and I think that circumstance determined me to accept the invitation. I felt interested in a man who seemed more exaggeratedly reserved than myself. When he saw my horse's breast fairly pushing the barrier, he did put his hand to unchain it, and then sullenly preceded me up the causeway, calling, as we entered the court, "Joseph, take Mr. Lockwood's horse and bring him up some wine." "Here we have the whole establishment of domestics, I suppose," was the reflection suggested by this compound order. "No wonder the grass grows up between the flags, and cattle are the only hedge-cutters." Joseph was an elderly, nay, an old man, very old. Perhaps, though hale and sinewy. "The Lord help us," he soliloquized in an undertone of peevish displeasure, while relieving me of my horse. looking meantime in my face so sourly that I charitably conjectured he must have need to divine aid to digest his dinner, and his pious ejaculation had no reference to my unexpected advent. Wuthering Heights is the name of Mr. Heathcliff's dwelling, Wuthering being a significant provincial adjective, descriptive of the atmospheric tumult to which its station is exposed in stormy weather. Pure, bracing ventilation they must have up there at all times. Indeed, one may guess the power of the north wind blowing over the edge by the excessive slant of a few stunted firs at the end of the house, and by a range of gaunt thorns all stretching their limbs one way, as if craving alms of the sun. Happily, the architect had foresight to build it strong. The narrow windows are deeply set in the wall, and the corners defended with large jutting stones. Before passing the threshold, I paused to admire a quantity of grotesque carvings lavished over the front, and especially about the principal door, above which, among a wilderness of crumbling griffins and shameless little boys, I detected the date 1500 and the name Harriton Earnshaw. I would have made a few comments and requested a short history of the place from the surly owner, but his attitude at the door appeared to demand my speedy entrance, or complete departure, and I had no desire to aggravate his impatience previous to inspecting the penetralium. One step brought us into the family sitting room. Without any introductory lobby or passage, they call it here the house, preeminently. It includes kitchen and parlour, generally, but I believe at Wuthering Heights the kitchen is forced to retreat altogether into another quarter. At least I distinguished a chatter of tongues and a clatter of culinary utensils deep within, and I observed no signs of roasting, boiling, or baking about the huge fireplace, nor any glitter of copper saucepans and tin calendars on the walls. One end, indeed, reflected splendidly both light and heat from ranks of immense pewter dishes, interspersed with silver jugs and tankards, towering row after row on a vast oak dresser to the very roof. The latter had never been underdrawn. Its entire anatomy lay bare to an inquiring eye, except where a frame of wood laden with oat cakes and clusters of legs of beef, mutton, and ham concealed it. Above the chimney were sundry villainous old guns and a couple of horse pistols, and, by way of ornament, three gaudily painted canisters disposed along its ledge. The floor was a smooth, white stone, the chairs high-backed, primitive structures, painted green, one or two heavy black ones lurking in the shade. In an arch under the dresser reposed a huge liver-coloured bitch pointer surrounded by a swarm of squealing puppies and other dogs haunted other recesses. The apartment and furniture would have been nothing extraordinary as belonging to a homely northern farmer with a stubborn countenance and stalwart limbs set out to advantage in knee breeches and gaiters. Such an individual seated in his armchair, his mug of ale frothing on the round table before him, is to be seen in any circuit of 5 or 6 miles among these hills, if you go at the right time after dinner. But Mr. Heathcliff forms a singular contrast to his abode and style of living. He is a dark-skinned gypsy in aspect, in dress and manners a gentleman, that is, as much a gentleman as many a country squire, rather slovenly perhaps, yet not looking amiss with his negligence, because he has an erect and handsome figure, and rather morose. Possibly some people might suspect him of a degree of underbred pride. I have a sympathetic chord within that tells me it is nothing of the sort. I know, by instinct, his reserve springs from an aversion to showy displays of feeling, to manifestations of mutual kindliness. He'll love and hate equally under cover, and esteem it a species of impertinence to be loved or hated again. No, I'm running on too fast. I bestow my own attributes over liberally on him. Mr. Heathcliff may have entirely dissimilar reasons for keeping his hand out of the way when he meets a would-be acquaintance, to those which actuate me. Let me hope my constitution is almost peculiar. My dear mother used to say I should never have a comfortable home, and only last summer I proved myself perfectly unworthy of one. While enjoying a month of fine weather at the sea coast, I was thrown into the company of a most fascinating creature, a real goddess in my eyes, as long as she took no notice of me. I never told my love vocally. Still, if looks have language, the merest idiot might have guessed I was over head and ears. She understood me at last, and looked a return, the sweetest of all imaginable looks. And what did I do? I confess, with shame, I shrunk icily into myself, like a snail, at every glance retired colder and farther, till finally the poor innocent was led to doubt her own senses, and, overwhelmed with confusion at her supposed mistake, persuaded her mother to decamp. By this curious turn of disposition, I have gained the reputation of deliberate heartlessness. How undeserved, I alone can appreciate. I took a seat at the end of the hearthstone opposite that towards which my landlord advanced, and filled up an interval of silence by attempting to caress the canine mother, who had left her nursery, and was sneaking, wolfishly, to the back of my legs, her lip curled, and her white teeth watering for a snatch. My caress provoked a long guttural gnarl. "You'd better let that dog alone," growled Mr. Heathcliff in unison, checking fiercer demonstrations with a punch of his foot. "She's not accustomed to be spoiled, not kept for a pet." Then, striding to a door, he shouted again, "Joseph!" Joseph mumbled indistinctly in the depths of the cellar, but gave no intimation of ascending, so his master dived down to him, leaving me vis-a-vis the ruffianly bitch and a pair of grim shaggy sheepdogs who shared with her a jealous guardianship over all my movements. Not anxious to come in contact with their fangs, I sat still, but imagining they would scarcely understand tacit insults, I unfortunately indulged in winking and making faces at the trio, and some turn of my physiognomy so irritated Madame that she suddenly broke into a fury and leapt on my knees. I flung her back and hastened to interpose the table between us. This proceeding aroused the whole hive. Half a dozen four-footed fiends of various sizes and ages issued from hidden dens to the common centre. I felt my heels and coat laps peculiar subjects of assault, and, parrying off the larger combatants as effectually as I could with the poker, I was constrained to demand aloud assistance from some of the household in re-establishing peace. Mr. Heathcliff and his man climbed the cellar steps with vexatious phlegm. I don't think they moved one second faster than usual, though the hearth was an absolute tempest of worry and yelping. Happily, an inhabitant of the kitchen made more dispatch. A lusty dame with tucked-up gown, bare arms, and fire-flushed cheeks rushed into the midst of us flourishing a frying pan, and used that weapon and her tongue to such purpose that the storm subsided magically, and she only remained heaving like a sea after a high wind when her master entered on the scene. "What the devil is the matter?" he asked, eyeing me in a manner that I could ill endure after this inhospitable treatment. "What the devil indeed," I muttered. "The herd of possessed swine could have had no worse spirits in them than those animals of yours, sir. You might as well leave a stranger with a brood of tigers." "They won't meddle with persons who touch nothing," he remarked, putting the bottle before me and restoring the displaced table. "The dogs do right to be vigilant. Take a glass of wine." "No, thank you." "Not bitten, are you?" "If I had been, I would have set my signet on the biter." Heathcliff's countenance relaxed into a grin. "Come, come," he said. "You are flurried, Mr. Lockwood. Here, take a little wine. Guests are so exceedingly rare in this house that I and my dogs, I am willing to own, hardly know how to receive them. Your health, sir." I bowed and returned the pledge, beginning to perceive that it would be foolish to sit sulking for the misbehaviour of a pack of curs, Besides, I felt loth to yield the fellow further amusement at my expense, since his humour took that turn. He probably swayed by a prudential consideration of the folly of offending a good tenant, relaxed a little in the lexonic style of chipping off his pronouns and auxiliary verbs, and introduced what he supposed would be a subject of interest to me. A discourse on the advantages and disadvantages of my present place of retirement. I found him very intelligent on the topics we touched, and before I went home I was encouraged so far as to volunteer another visit tomorrow. He evidently wished no repetition of my intrusion. I shall go, notwithstanding. It is astonishing how sociable I feel myself compared with him. All right, there we go. First chapter of Wuthering Heights. Check. That was quite pleasant to read. So a few very long sentences, very winding sentences here and there, which I stumbled over around a little bit. But other than that, it flowed. It really flowed. By comparison to Joyce especially, that really flowed. Quite nice. Okay, well, I'll leave a few discussion prompts in the subreddit, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Jump over there, have a look for the discussion forum, have your say about this chapter. I don't have much immediately to say. I am looking forward to hearing what you guys think, though. Especially just the first chapter of a new author, I'm always curious, mostly just what do you make of their style, of their sort of prose style? Go over to the subreddit and have a chat. And your comments will be part of the next episode. You know the drill, you know how this works. Also, if you would like to support the podcast, the creation of the podcast, a donation over at our Patreon page would be awesome. Very much appreciated. You can subscribe and be a Patreon subscriber. Ongoing support for as little as $1 per month. $1 a month, so you'll be getting about 30 episodes of the podcast for $1. That's a pretty good rate to sponsor something at. Of course, you can go over that if you like. You can sponsor for whatever you want, or you can just listen for free if you'd also like to do that. No problem at all. But I do thank you for considering that. If you have a look at the Patreon page, if you haven't already seen this, I have been having a bit of fun translating chapters of War and Peace into Bogan Australian. Whole chapters. I've translated the entire chapter into Bogan Australian. Those are quite entertaining. My idea is potentially to do the entire book. That's what I'd like to do, but it's quite time-consuming, and so I've kind of set goals, subscription goals. So when I am getting, when I hit the first goal of support on Patreon, I'll be able to use that support money to support myself in translating more chapters, if that makes sense. So at the moment, I'm just doing one chapter every week or so, maybe two chapters a week. But then when I hit that first goal, the project will be financed to the first degree, and then I'll be able to say, okay, I will do one chapter every 3 days at this rate of finance. And then, because that's just sort of how much time I can afford to spend on it without having to go out and do Uber driving to pay my bills. It is a pretty cheap rate. Really, it's just to sort of subsidize my time, because it's a lot of hours to spend on a hobby that may or may not pay off at all. Anyway, I do thank you for checking that out. Go have a read of some of those chapters. I hope that all makes sense. Of course, you don't have to finance anything. You don't have to donate if you don't want to. Cool. All right. I think I went on about that for a little bit too long. I'll try to keep that in check next time. Hey, first chapter down of Wuthering Heights. I am very excited for this book. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to reading your comments, and I will see you tomorrow.